From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
All right, good evening, everyone. It's been 2 weeks since we last talked about Making a Murderer, the 10-part Netflix series. And my next guest, Christina Stoy, from the litigation support firm of Stoy Wigmore Associates, is back, and we're going to continue talking about that and other things. Welcome back, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. Now, what about this Donald Trump guy? He's I promise you I wasn't going to say anything about him, but I never keep my promises. He's not going to the debate and all that. Doesn't he kind of remind you of a cross between, well, let's say Tony Soprano and Bozo the Clown? Or is that just me?
One of the things I think he does really well is nobody can quite label him better than he can. And as we started, I hoped you wouldn't ask because I just heard his line from the Iowa caucus, and I'm seriously having to giggle, like cover my giggle all day, to say I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone, and I still wouldn't lose a voter.
Yeah.
Who says that?
I don't know. And I hope the people of the United States make up their mind about him very quickly. Anyway, Making a Murderer, this is our part two of that. But before we get started, there is some news about a story that you and I have covered many times here on Scared Monkeys Radio and Channel 7 about the missing young guy, Kyron Horman. What's going on there?
Well, for the first time in over 5.5 years, Terry Horman, Kyron, his stepmother, gave her first interview to Elaine Ardias from People Magazine, and a series of ABC-based interviews as well. And certainly the reaction was strong, coming from Kyron's biological mother, Desiree Young.
Right.
Very little from Dad. I think he just had a very brief reaction and then gave a bunch of no comment. No comment from Multnomah County Sheriff, no comment from the district attorney. You know, lots of social media buzz, of course. You know, we've been covering this case for over 5.5 years. I'm going to say conservatively, I might have 100 articles on it, maybe 100,000 comments. It is certainly one of the stronger interested cases that I've covered in my tenure, for sure.
Yeah, 5.5 years, it doesn't seem that long, but,
I know.
You know, I guess it seems like an eternity for the family. Now, you've got some connections, and I'm sure we'll see more about that on your webpage. What do you think about this interview 5.5 years later?
I am actually going to be interviewing Ms. Horman.
Right on.
So, I'll temper my comments with that. I'll also share with you that I elected not to be for her first interview. And I'll share with you why. Part of, you know, is that is going to be heard with the, are you crazy? You're a terrible journalist. and I am a better analyst than I am a journalist. I think I admit that up front. But for what I, you know, in my, I guess, conversations and understanding of some of the, not just from Ms. Horman, but from the years of interviews and witnesses and network that I've developed surrounding this case, I've never seen a scintilla of evidence. When I say evidence, I'm talking about the legal term, relevant material evidence
right.
of somebody's guilt. I've never seen it with her. In fact, early on, there were witnesses that I interviewed that were adamant that Kyron never left with her, and I believe that strongly to this day. So when you talk about that, you know, and then, of course, in 2013, I interviewed who was widely held her, air quote, accomplice, Dee Dee Spicer. And for me to have interviewed her And as you recall, she was really like, you know, the cog in the wheel of the linchpin that was
yep.
the suspect, Terry Horman. You know, it was never separated. It was, okay, this is the theory. She had to be involved. So when you took away her involvement, on top of the fact that, again, I've, you know, developed witness accounts that did not corroborate that Terry Horman had anything to do with it. Now, did it help her that, you know, her criminal attorney and in her civil dissolution case really rendered her speechless? And I say that because of, you know, her right to her Fifth Amendment. Two grand juries later, she's speaking out. I mean, that's huge news. Something's going on that she's not afraid of anymore.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, and we'll give a plug out for your webpage here in a little bit and remind the folks later on. But stay tuned. There will be more on that fascinating story. Now, we're here tonight, part two, Making a Murder, 10-part series on Netflix. I'm sure all of the listeners, or if you're tuning in the first time, have either heard about it or seen it or watched part of it. I'm actually on my second run of it. Haven't quite finished it yet. I'm still, we'll get into what I believe and what I don't believe here in a little bit. But it's a fascinating piece of work. And someone asked me today about the show, and they were giving me a bit of a hard time saying, how can you not believe that he's not guilty? They railroaded him the first time, so they must have railroaded him the second time. And I just kind of bit my tongue and I changed the topic right away. But can you imagine, with today's media, the way it is, you got a chump like Trump that's dominating the media about him and Bill O'Reilly and milkshakes and all that. Yet we've got a story here about this murder. These two defense lawyers who I consider to be geniuses when it comes to, yeah, they lost the case, and this will probably go nowhere now. But to use this media the way that they've been using it, or had used it, very slanted in my opinion. What about that? Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Yes. I'm going to revert that to OJ. I'm going to revert that to Casey Anthony. Yes, I have. I have seen how media can shape public opinion and how they can shape trial outcomes. But interestingly enough, to your point, I don't know that I've seen it in a post-conviction and post-appellate situation like Steve Avery is in. And to add to that, what I also find amazing, and we haven't touched on some of this, so I don't want to get ahead of the conversation of you, but it's not just Steve Avery, it's the nephew Brendan Dassey that,
yeah.
in my view, has the strongest appellate brief and case over Stephen Avery. So for me, not only am I looking at this saying, what a tremendous phenomenon, but I'm also going, okay, does anybody get that in a sense these two are really, even though the charges were bifurcated, do they get how connected these are? And is the strategy correct? Because I'm not sure that I think it is.
Christina Stoys here. We're talking about Making a Murder, and I think we're going to be jumbled up a little bit tonight, but that's okay. We'll work it out. Some of the media since last time, and that's why I waited 2 weeks to do this part. It has slowed down a little bit, but there was the pro-Stephen Avery side. There was the anti-Stephen Avery side. I think Investigation Discovery or someone is going to come out with a pro-prosecution documentary. The prosecutor, well, whatever his name is, has come out to admit,
Ken Pratt.
Yeah, to come out to say that he was a bit of a ding-dong. And Avery is blamed his lawyers, blamed his brothers, and his mother says that the poor young girl isn't even dead. Now, that sort of media is not going to, I think, change the case much. But what, in your opinion, might change this case?
For Stephen Avery, I believe entirely the only thing that will change his case is his new representation, who is Kathleen Zellner. Zellner is by far one of the, if not the best, post-trial conviction appellate attorneys in the country. Her team has exonerated if they're exonerated post-conviction, then the argument is that they were wrongfully convicted. I am aware of a handful of their cases intimately, and she's quite spectacular. I mean, she just is. But my point is as far as Stephen Avery is concerned, and this is a little bit why I, you know, media shining a light on systemic, jurisdictional and, you know, procedural American problems is critically important.
I think so, too.
It's critically important. Let's see where the rubber meets the road here, and how do we fix it? Because it is an epidemic. Anybody that I could name five cases off the top of my head. I think I shared with you a figure. If I didn't, just in terms of in Chicago, what Chicago police have paid out in terms of payments to claimants for police misconduct.
No,
Come on.
Now, I've never done this. You and I have done these shows for years, and we've never snipped at each other, but I'm going to get after you here a little bit.
It's a fact. They paid over $500 million.
Well, what's that got to do with the Avery case?
Because they're claiming that there was police misappropriation.
They're claiming
evidence was planted. That's their argument, not mine.
And what's the defense's argument with the whatever the DDTA, with the DNA? And they come back, the FBI lab comes back and says that there's no way that blood could have been planted in the vehicle. And then there's a clip of the defense lawyers, and he says, well, I don't trust the FBI. Well, how easy is that to come forward and say, well, that guy must be wrong. We're right. That blood was planted. This is wrong. But to compare it to Chicago, yes, there's all sorts of crap going on in Chicago. Chicago is one of the toughest gun control cities that there is in the United States, but has the highest murder rates. It's bigger than that. It's a lot bigger than that. And the story to see with Stephen Avery, and just to come back and say, well, that evidence had to have been planted, and when they come back with evidence to show that it wasn't, to say, well, I don't trust those guys, that just shows that this documentary is so slanted the wrong way. Okay, I'm done. I won't yell at you anymore.
I didn't consider that yelling at me. I think you make valid points. But at the end of the day, this is really hard to impart, because I think what the documentary did, to your point, was raise the cockles of the emotions of people to the point that you rarely see that. You know, you're having people driving to work antsy in the morning.
That's right.
You're having people going to work saying, oh my God, did you see this? You have 50,000 Redditors posting about it, 1,200 at a clip. You have people that have never been online that are doing that. So start there and then work backward in what nobody wants to hear. And this is just legal stuff.
I know. Have I ever posted to your forum before?
I don't know.
No.
You did in this case.
I did.
I don't know that if you have ever before.
If I have, I'm getting old and I've forgotten. But here's the sergeant who in the documentary, and he makes a phone call, which was weird, or it's either a phone call or a radio dispatch, doesn't matter.
Colburn.
And he runs the plate of the vehicle.
Yep.
And the girl gives him the information back. Well, all of a sudden, the conspiracy theorists jumped on that right away, said, oh, he must have had the vehicle 2 days before it was located. And I replied very briefly, if one jurisdiction calls another and says, hey, by the way, can you keep a lookout for this vehicle, we've had a reported missing person, could that officer not just be confirming the information that he has is correct?
If the information that he received from Mark Weigert included her license plate, yes. But when he was asked if he was given the license plate number from Mark Weigert, he said, I don't know.
You know what? And I think that there's a lot more to that testimony, and you've read it.
I have now,
and
by the way. I have. Every word of it.
He had the crap. Can I say crap on the radio? Anyway, he had the crap. kicked out of him on that stand. And as far as being able to testify, I've testified in court hundreds of times.
Sure.
And it's probably one of the most difficult things to do. He was being put on trial. He was being accused of all sorts of different things. But, again, to look at that, I threw out a scenario that the defense threw out that it must have been planted. But to look at the documentary, and I think that's what we're talking about, and you make a valid point, that it looks at the system in the United States the way that it is now. It takes away from every good case that has, and I'm not saying this one's bad, but it takes away from every good case that has been successfully investigated, taken to court, and proven. You, as well as anybody, knows that there's never that perfect case. That smoking gun, that videotape, that confession. How do you prove cases? You have three pieces of evidence. You have witness testimony, you have confession from the accused, or you have forensic evidence. Not very often do you get all three tied in together perfectly, and I think that's where some people are missing in this case. And the way that the documentary was presented, in my opinion, is that the cops must have been bad. I have a very strange, and you're going to think I'm nuts, opinion on the first case, too, and we'll get into that later. What do you think? Am I totally out to lunch? Should I be committed?
I hope nobody out there listening has a peanut allergy, because Dana's nuts.
Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think it's fair, because there's a danger in dismissing something you don't agree with as an individual that you see. And this is going to get back to something you and I have discussed at length before in different cases, and I call it the CSI effect. It's real. People looking at what they saw in this documentary, an example would be, everybody uses this term evidence, and I will absolutely state that is my biggest pet peeve in life. Evidence is determined to be relevant or material based on law, based on admissibility. So when I see this person saying, well, this, referring to this as evidence, say for the sake of argument, Avery gets a new trial. And when I say this, I have every doubt that that will happen. I don't care if it's Kathleen Zellner, I don't care if it's whatever. Is it okay if I tell you my opinion on his guilt or innocence?
Have I ever told you not to tell me something?
No, but I didn't know if you were at a point where that made sense.
No.
I do believe there are two instances, at the very least, where I believe that evidence was planted, and it has to do with the key and the lanyard. And my research concludes that that happened, in my mind. The blood, the this, the that, the other, whether or not somebody took a hypodermic needle and put it all over the car, I don't believe. I believe Stephen Avery injured himself, started that vehicle, bled in it, and I believe she died and was dead in the back of that vehicle, was burned 20 feet from his house. So, and most compellingly, which a lot of people don't realize, is there is a bullet fragment containing her DNA shot from his gun in his garage, which supports the Dassey comment. Which, by the way, I believe was an inappropriate and coerced statement.
Oh, you got me going again, but okay.
I'm gonna. But I do believe there's valid evidence to conclude Avery's involvement in her murder, and I don't think you're getting past that. Do I think, I've read this, and this incenses me. I've heard people say, if you believe evidence was planted, then you have to think he's innocent. I don't agree with that at all.
No, that's true, yeah.
I don't agree with that. I think the key was planted because they legitimately thought he was guilty. And they were very concerned that he was going to... I think they thought he was guilty the first time. I think they thought he was guilty again. And there was a great concern that he would use that whole issue and get out of it. I do believe that key was planted. There's nobody that's going to convince me it happened otherwise. Not the way that they portrayed it. I'll never believe it. But I do also think he killed her. So I think it's possible that you can examine the facts of the case and you can say, okay, this happened and that happened. But you're not getting out of the basic forensics. Not every test is bad. Not every conclusion is poor. Was it put up to the, you know, so it comes down to this, Dean. It comes down to what laws were they operating under in Wisconsin in 2005? And, you know, people that don't necessarily want to hear about the law and just want an opinion are probably not going to, you know, or their eyes are glazing over right now. But it is a very big fact that in 2005, Wisconsin did not have what's called the Daubert or Frye standard, and that is what is applied to evidence as to whether it is probative or inflammatory, and also whether it can be duplicated in a relative scientific test. So I'll tell you right off the top, if that gets applied in another trial, then the DNA on the bullet fragment, it's not coming in because the test was invalid based on lab protocol because Culhane contaminated it. Even though I happen to personally agree that her control result was fine, I think it actually was Halbach's DNA, but I'm talking about what's admissible and what's not. And so you have that issue, and the fact that the defense couldn't test their own sample or be present during the sampling under today's standards, that's never coming in. So it goes like that. It goes, okay, so under these standards, what happened? And if it does get retried today, could you know, there be a successful prosecution? Nobody's going to convince me that, you know, somebody's digging up burnt bones from someplace else, putting them in his burn pit, piling them up, putting, you know, a van seat on it. That happened. It's just preposterous and ridiculous to think it didn't happen.
If you're just tuning in, welcome to Thursday Night at the Fights between my guest, Christine Estoy,
and Cruz up here,
and and myself. If you're missing the debate on Fox, according to Donald Trump, no one's going to watch it anyway, so don't worry about that. Okay, well, you know, we could, you know what, by the end of this, we might do a part three, but we'll see where this is going. And some of it I agree with you, some of it I don't, and that's why you and I enjoy doing these shows the way that we do them. Anyway,
sure.
How many times can I say anyway? I'm going to dance around here a little bit, and I'm looking at an article that I think it's the Associated Press or somewhere. It's titled, "He's a Monster. Stephen Avery's ex-fiancé claims he's guilty of killing Teresa Halbach." Okay, so you see that kind of stuff, and it's been dancing back and forth, but nobody really analyzes what's out there, to be honest with you, except you. You know, I've seen the Dr. Phil stuff and the Nancy Gray
right.
stuff, and it's all been one-sided and thought about and all this sort of stuff. But what you're doing and what we're doing here is we're actually analyzing it, and one thing I want to talk about is the nephew. Now, in my opinion, and I'm not going to get into exactly why I think this way, in my opinion, I think that the nephew did tell the truth in his statement, that he did see what was going on. I'm not sure if he participated. His mental capacity is questionable at best. I totally disagree with you that it was a coerced statement, because I've taken statements from people. I've taken statements from murder suspects. You don't sit down as a law enforcement officer when you know that the evidence, the physical evidence itself, maybe is thin, and you want that, remember that pie, you want that witness or that admission. You don't sit down with that person and say, "Did you do it?" "Yeah, no." "Okay, well, thank you." You spend some time. Now, having the mother in there and not and at the school and all that sort of stuff, that's for a court to decide, in my opinion. I don't think it was coerced at all. However, with the nephew, and I think there was a cousin, a female cousin, that was
yeah.
a little clip in the story itself, I think those witnesses were very important to the case against Stephen Avery. I'm not sure the nephew should be spending the time that he is in jail right now, and if anybody deserves another trial, it's him. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with your end comment that I I do believe that he deserves another trial. And to your point, backing up, your point about the fact that media, mainstream media, is not analyzing the points of the case, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's maddening. It's absolutely maddening. You're only as good, your interview is only as good as your knowledge of the case to potentially corroborate or impeach your witness. Now, that's legalese, but it works exactly the same in interviewing. Not that you're going to do the gotcha, you know, type of interview, but you should know the, if you're going to dispute something, an example would be, I know you're going to, your eyes are rolling back of your head, Nancy Grace, screaming, you know, I saw 5 seconds of it and I went, how can you have a position if you do not even understand the evidence in the case?
Yeah.
You can't say, oh, he lied to the grocer, and that's evidence of somebody's guilt in a murder. She's a former prosecutor. I just feel like the case deserved more. If you're going to take it on, but honestly, I think you and I have talked about this before. I keep answering this on my blog as well. I call it the murder business. Full credit to Mark Furman. If you've never read that book, he expressly puts into words, which, you know, throat closes up trying to explain it, to how the media perpetuates cases by not asking the right questions and therefore not getting presumptive or closed answers, because then people are disinterested. If they think they know everything, the curiosity goes away. And what happens when the curiosity goes away? So does the interest. And I believe that is entirely true across the board. And I think a little bit, that's, if you notice, like, the very few interviews that Dean Strang or Jerry Buting did, who I would agree with your earlier comment, they're absolutely criminal defense geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that maybe not everybody can categorically say that, but having read through now the entire Avery transcript on top of it, I don't even know, Dana, it might be 4,000 pages again, something ridiculous like that. But this guy's arguments, I mean, he's like butter. you walk around going, I wish some of that would wash off. You know what I mean? Just could he sweat on me? Something, osmosis. But at the end of the day, with that, when going back to that, so that's my issue with the media, because aren't you obligated in some fashion, if you're gonna have a position, you do need to analyze all the facts, and that is what gets to me, because I don't think it's fair that you can, you know, raise the cackles of you know, the populace and say, okay, how about 200,000 of you write to the White House and ask for a pardon? But did anybody stop to tell these people he can't pardon them? It's a state case.
A few years ago, I did a commentary about Charles Manson. Charles Manson was up for parole, and that commentary ended up on YouTube. And part of the commentary was me saying that, you know, justice, when the death penalty went away from California, and justice will maybe be served in jail instead of the way that it should have been. That commentary on YouTube, I think, received 180,000 or 190,000 views. And I got probably almost that many hateful emails from Charles Manson fans suggesting that if he was out, he would do all these weird and wonderful things to me. I thought it was fantastic. So there's that dark side that's out there. Let me take that back.
Oh, yes. I absolutely agree with you.
I'll take that back. I won't say dark side, because just because people don't agree with my opinion or yours doesn't mean they're dark, but other opinions. But, you know, talking about Natalie Holloway the way that we did for years here, believe me, there's a dark side out there. So you're going to get those people that are anti-police no matter what to say that, oh, he must be innocent. They framed him the first time, but, you know, so they must have framed him the second time. Here's my point. That sheriff's department, when they did one of the biggest, stupidest things that the prosecutor did was that press conference where he sat there with the sheriff and they went through all the gruesome details. That was just a glory grab. He was happy to be in front of the cameras. He admits himself he was a nut or a dipstick or something during that time. That's besides the point. But when they agreed that that sheriff's department would have nothing to do with this case, and then they jumped in all over it, that's the big problem here, and I think that's what's turning a lot of people. Now, you know, the first case, yes, he was exonerated by DNA, but I ask you the question, did anybody ever ask the question if he was hooked up with that guy? Could he have been there? Did she pick out the right person in the first place? Yes, she said it was only one, but could have been two. I don't know. Now I'm starting to become a conspiracy theorist, but is this something that you look at when you see the sheriff's department, and they made a big point of the logs, the defense lawyers, again, geniuses, saying that you guys were supposed to be there, but here you were there by yourselves. That's where that sheriff's department shot themselves in the foot. As far as planting evidence, but that's where they made a big mistake.
I totally agree with that. They had no business there, and they were there. Make no mistake. They were there 12 hours a day, every day, for the 8 days that property was under lockdown. And not only that, Sheriff Pagel from Calumet ensured the public that Manitowoc was not involved. So the fact that the public had literally no faith anymore in Manitowoc is against the grain of what a police department or a sheriff's department is supposed to be in the first place. I totally agree with you. They had no business there. They shouldn't have been there. And they knew it. And so the question becomes, when you got Link that's volunteering, and I've read his deposition, he couldn't remember what days he was there. He said he had to ask his wife, because if he wasn't at work, he was with her. I mean, by the way, I don't want a guy that doesn't have a roster or know his duties as a lieutenant in the first place. If you can't say what you did on your duties in a day, which is standard protocol, that's weird.
What should have happened is there should have been a federal inquiry into that. Police
department. There
was. Well, I know.
In the first case.
And, you know, the idiot that answers the phone and he gets the call, you've got the wrong guy, and he writes up the memo 5 years later.
Over.
That's just sloppy. That's just stupid.
Right.
That's just stupid is what it is. But
you know what it is? It's windows to a defense.
Yeah.
What it
exactly.
is. Exactly. And what the law in Wisconsin is called the Denny decision. It's called a third liability clause. So what that says and what was ruled in this case, literally, the only defense that Buting and Strang were allowed was, it's called a frame-up defense. They were forced into that. And I've seen Strang interviewed a few times, and it's, you know, he's such a charming guy in the first place. He's like, listen, there is no sane lawyer that wants to blame police for a cover-up or say that they planted evidence. He goes, there is no sane lawyer that ever wants to do that. And I would agree with that. You better know. If you're going to bring that, it better be factual, it better be correct, and you better be able to prove it every way to Sunday. Because to your point, it does, in my view, if it gives a poor, you know, public opinion of police conduct.
You bet.
That thing is spread like wildfire. Let's be honest. Right now in this country, the police in general don't really need another, you know, knock, so to speak. That's wrong, because there are some fantastic officers. They have mentored. I'm friends with them. They've mentored me. In my opinion, some of the best detectives in the world. And not everybody. And it doesn't mean that if there's one rotten egg, that they all are. And know something else. When I'm in trouble, guess who I'm calling?
Yeah.
So I would like to, you know, I don't think it's fair, and I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it serves any citizen to have that mindset. So I think a bit, you know, we have to think about how the media portrays. You know, I think about it. It doesn't, when I say I think that was planted, for me, that is a really... It's not. I don't say that lightly. I've considered it. I've looked at the evidence. I've gone through transcripts. I don't agree with the rest of this stuff. And by the end of the day, once this guy's convicted, unless you're willing to show that, you know, that key was relevant to a jury's decision and they would not have found otherwise, it doesn't even matter.
You know, we talked a little bit. If you're just tuning in on Channel 7 or Scared Monkeys Radio, Christina Stoy's here. And this is our part two of Making a Murderer, the 10-part Netflix series. You know, we talked a little bit last show about the jury system itself and what something, you know, we can go through all the cases about, you know, the jury having civilians, ma and pa, on that jury who don't understand some of the technical terms or some of the things that they're saying. You know, a change of venues and all this sort of stuff. Avery's, well, everybody knows Avery's. He must be guilty. You know, we talked about that last time, and even in the community I am, and it's true. You sit down as a law enforcement officer, and something comes in, and you're going to think that, oh, gee, I wonder if so-and-so is involved. But it's a lot bigger picture than that. And the question I want to ask you, we know what happened. We know that the documentary was made, and you have your opinion, I have my opinion, and all that. But Stephen Avery's in jail, the nephew's in jail, there's the media has slowed down a little bit, whether or not any of the, and I think will eventually disappear unless he does get a new trial. I personally don't think he will, or he should get. The nephew's another case. But what about that next guy that's out there, or that next case that's before the courts right now, and you have that documentary filmmaker that's saying, hey, here's another one right now. This is so positive about police and corruption and all that sort of stuff. You may not get the guy that was exonerated once after 16 years, but you may get that other documentary, and maybe that's not fair, or maybe it is. What about that?
Well, to your point, I'm going to answer you two ways. I'm aware of a documentary of the case, I've never written on it, and I don't believe you and I have ever discussed it. I'm positive you're aware of it. It's Michael Peterson,
right?
Author. He's in his second trial, about to start his second trial for the murder of his wife. His original guilty verdict was overturned due to kind of like an overreach on behalf of an expert, which, by the way, is a huge problem, especially in North Carolina. You know, the land of Nifong. So there's that. So when you talk about documentaries and what it means, I think that we need to be careful about our own biases going into that, our own level of knowledge, our own advocacy, because it's like stereotyping. It's like, some way, what would be a term for like almost a racism for how we look at some of these things.
Yeah.
Because I am flat out convinced that guy is as guilty as a day long, not because of his wife's murder, but of a lover over in Germany whose daughters, you know, ended up in his care. And, you know, it's odd that we're having this conversation because I literally was looking at the autopsy protocol last night, and they're looking at defending this guy as if she was killed in an owl attack. And at some point, it's almost rude to our system and rude to our law that some of these ridiculous concepts come into play. But when you have a prosecutor or you have an asset, let's remember how this is structured. The presumption of innocence is guaranteed. It is your constitutional right. That is what was missing from a lot of. The message was clear if you watched Making a Murderer. It's true that the system is very much not geared towards that presumption in many jurisdictions. It certainly wasn't in Avery's case. And so that's the first problem. However, that's a constitutional right. So is, right to counsel. These are things are not, you talk about how juries of their peers, and I think many years ago we were, I want to say, discussing Anthony, and I said to you, I'm a huge proponent for professional juries. I'm tired of this.
Yep.
because I've had it. These people are, do not, it's at a point where you have to realize that sequestering them, or whether or not they put their own biases in, or whether or not they're influenced, this is a different social media, you know, high profile cases are a different animal. Now, who's going to rewrite the Magna Carta and the Constitution to say jury of peers equals, you know, a professional jury? It's not going to be you and it's not going to be me. But at some point, you know, hopefully the Supreme Court's going to realize that this is a huge problem. And we're going to have to think about that as a society, is how that goes forward. And not just because of what you said, but, and I do agree with you that if you're thinking about how do you go forward, then is a correct conviction then subject to, you know, police misconduct or prosecutorial misconduct or, you know, testing DNA that would never even exonerate a person anyway, so that we're spending this exorbitant amount of money and we have this person in the system and they're not being prosecuted to the fullest extent. Their due process is, you know, hindering other people's due process, and that could be a really big problem. But not just that. It colors cases that I'm aware of. I'll give you an example. A guy by the name of David Kam, state trooper, tried 3 times for the murder of his wife and children, even though they had DNA of the murderer, who was definitely not him, who they tried to use as a witness and connect him to this guy. He was exonerated. He's the other guy seeking $40 million right now for wrongful incarceration. And I'm going to tell you, I think he's going to get it.
You know,
it was that.
You know, and I didn't mean to take it in that direction, but I'm kind of glad you responded the way that you did. Christina Stoyce here. We're talking about the 10-part miniseries on Netflix, Making a Murder. I've said many times, and you haven't yet, but I've said many times that I believe that the documentary was slanted towards the defense, very little from the family. Anything prosecutorial-wise was anti-police. Am I wrong?
No, I absolutely believe it was slanted to the defense. If I didn't articulate that correctly, or maybe I held off on agreeing with you so we could fight a little bit.
This is the first time I've asked you.
Oh, okay. No, I absolutely believe it was slanted to the defense. It was, you know, I think it was an important project. I think it was brilliant. I think to say, when you're, you know, Moira or Laura, to come away from this and say we didn't have an agenda or an opinion about systemic problems, it's just false.
Yeah.
Because if you edit a piece, okay, so basic is there's 700 hours of footage, they come out with 10. So there's 690 hours of footage that hasn't been presented. You could argue that editorial, it doesn't work, it doesn't work for Netflix, blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is nobody, you know, if you've got, what was it, I don't know, how many million views, you got to know that in some context you're hitting on a social hot button.
Yep.
And I don't believe that, I get as filmmakers and documentarians why they're trying to say, listen, we're just reporting a social problem, we didn't slant one way or another. But I disagree. I think it was slanted toward the defense. And I don't understand why they don't necessarily say that. And I'll give you Penny Bernstein, who was the rape victim and assault, attempted murder, really, in the first case that Avery was convicted in and later found out it was Gregory Allen. She was asked to participate or give an interview. And she told the filmmakers no, because... And this is why. She said, because I felt like they believed Stephen Avery was innocent, and that was their take, and I was not sure. So even she didn't, you know, say, oh, I thought he did it. But my point is that in her conversations with them, and I know she didn't see it in advance, so just based on their conversations alone, she felt that they were very highly slanted towards Avery's innocence. That speaks volumes to me. The same woman who literally apologized for putting him in prison in the first place, who absolutely believes 1,000% he should have been exonerated, At the end of the day, hears them talk and says, you know what? I mean, to me, that's the most non-biased person you're going to find in their position, you know, in her forming of their position after their conversation. I respect that.
No, I said at the start of this that I was going to jump all over the place, and by gosh, that's what I'm going to do. Let's talk about this, in your opinion, coerced statement from the nephew. Why do you think it was coerced?
Well, a variety of reasons. First of all, he's a juvenile. So his mother was not consulted prior to the first interview. She was only consulted after about 6 hours and was never told at the end of that he was looked at as a suspect. They literally told him that they believed that Stephen Avery was about to be let out of prison by his statement, and told him that for their safety they were going to put him up in a hotel, which they did. There is a missing transcript from a hotel conversation that happened that night. At the same time, Stephen Avery was put into, without breaking any jail rules, mind you, okay, so it's a violation of the prison, they put him in solitary. Then they say the day after that, once Brendan's still in custody and they're still interviewing him, that he's suicidal. So they shake down his cell, this and everything. All this is going on at the same time. Even if one didn't believe his statement was coerced at that juncture, fast forward to after the request for suppression is denied and Len Kaczynski agrees to have that nut job, emphasis on nut job, Michael O'Kelly, who is a defense investigator, that's what I do, by the way, but goes in there and interviews him, and he asserts his innocence. This is a juvenile, by the way, in a juvenile facility, asserts his innocence and says, I didn't do it. And he looks at him and he says, I can't help you. Unless you admit this and you're sorry, I can't help you. You flunked a polygraph. You know, here's the test that you have here. You have to tell me. And none of the evidence matched. If that wasn't bad enough, he calls up the defense attorney, who, by the way, is emailing back and forth with Kratz, and says, he's available for an interview tomorrow. I'll sit and I'll watch behind the window and I'll critique. The investigators themselves say, geez, you know what? We're a little concerned about the whole work product factor here, which, hello, everything I've said just now that actually happened is hugely unethical. It should have been suppressed on that alone. So they go into this. In the middle of it, he says, oh, that's not right. That's not what he told me yesterday. I'm talking about O'Kelly now. And literally tells one detective to sit on the other side because he thinks Brendan's favoring him. The number one thing that got me is that you will notice when, and by the way, there's some algorithms that we overlay onto this transcript in terms of who says what. And I can unequivocally tell you that in an interview and an investigation of a suspect who is a juvenile, who is mentally compromised, the majority of new information should never come from a detective. It should come from the suspect. And in particular, Mark Weigert says to him, he gets pissed off. He goes, all right, listen, I'm tired of beating around the bush. I'm just going to say it. Who shot her? Nobody knew she was shot. That information came finally months later from the forensic anthropologist, which I agree with her conclusions, but I do think it was defensible. But I happen to agree, I do believe she was shot, and I do believe that it could be proven in two different areas. But the point is, Brendan never said that. They told him that. And his responses are indicative of the casings that they found in the garage. That said, I also think some of what he told them lines up.
Yeah.
So the question for me becomes, okay, first of all, legally, is this called non-coerced confession? Well, I'm going to call it involuntary, if maybe you like that better.
Okay.
An involuntary confession. Is it legal? Is it admissible? I say absolutely not. Wisconsin said differently. Okay, that's fine. But then we say, okay, is there eventual discovery? In other words, it's called inevitable discovery under the law, that we were going to find some of this stuff out anyway. I would agree, no, you weren't going to find that out anyway because you didn't know where the fragments were until he told you. Basic positioning, you know what I mean? Like where the car was, where he was, where allegedly the body was. At the end of the day for me, then the question became, do I believe everything he said? Do I believe some of what he said? What lines up? And I don't believe he raped this girl. You'll never convince me that kid walked in there and Steve Avery said, oh, she's tied up. Do you want to see what sex is like? You know, go rape her. And he does. I'll never believe that. There's no evidence of it. There's no evidence of any injury in that house. In fact, when I'm listening to Steve Avery's, which I've analyzed, his only comments when the police were asking him, why is Teresa's blood in your house? He says, it ain't. There's no way. It ain't in there. The next question is, then why is your blood in her vehicle? His response was, oh, the county has all my blood. They have tons of my blood. What I'm looking at as an analyst is I believe he knew there was no blood in that trailer because she wasn't in. I believe he knew that emphatically. I also believe he knew there was blood in the vehicle because he bled in it. So if I'm analyzing those statements and I'm looking for deception, I'm looking for, you know, nonverbal and verbal cues, I see that in him. It's impossible to see in Brendan. He just doesn't exhibit, you know, those cues anywhere.
There, it wasn't in the documentary, but there is some media releases that Avery did buy some shackles before this. What are your thoughts on that?
3 weeks before. Actually, he bought them on the day of Teresa Kaulbach's last visit, October 10th.
I don't
know what time, but I know he bought them 3 weeks before that.
Who does that, unless you're planning on using them for something?
Well, not just that. Who does that when your girlfriend is locked up and not coming home for 5 months?
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah, it goes every different direction. Again, I think we're about 70-30 as far as I agree with you on 70% and disagree with you on 30%. But I think the bottom line is, and we're starting to run out of time a little bit, that the documentary itself is fascinating. In my opinion, it's very slanted towards the defense and is released at a convenient time where policing itself and across North America is under attack. I think Stephen Avery, in my opinion, is guilty of the murder, and I'm not 100% convinced that he isn't involved somehow in the first case, although exonerated, I do buy that. The nephew, okay. The statement, well, you got to get a statement somehow. Coerced is too strong. The other term that you used is better. But even so, the court accepted it. The appellate court accepted it. You know, where do you go from that? You can't start handcuffing law enforcement. It's difficult enough as it is. Before I retired, and that's not all that long ago, just a few months, it's getting to be more difficult to not have the policeman on trial when you go to court. I've used the term, especially in this country, hug-a-thug mentality. And there is that. Now, there is also corruption, and it's difficult to draw a line between the two and make it fair on either side. But I want to give you the last few minutes here to give your final thoughts on Making a Murderer on Netflix.
My final thoughts are, I don't believe Stephen Avery is going to get a new trial because it's going to be based on new evidence, and I would really like it if the focus publicly would be more on what I consider the critical systemic problems that people should be takeaways from that case that are, you know, workable, that are, you know, socially, you know, cognizant of other people. There were valid points within that documentary of things that are wrong with the system, and I'd like to see that taken away. I'm pretty firm on the involuntary nature of Brendan's confession. I am trained, I am advanced certified in interviewing and interrogation, if necessary, somebody that is a juvenile or mentally compromised. Although I will say this, when you're at a level at when you've got somebody in custody, as was the case, and this information develops, I can see the pressures that develop. These particular gentlemen were not trained in that way. And unfortunately, I think sometimes that's the problem. I don't think the protocol, I don't think the training is in place to, I guess, necessarily counter some of what can come out of a high-profile case. You and I have talked about this before. Once a case goes high-profile, if mistakes were made, you know what those are? They're like under, you know, the magnifying glass. And that is what it is. What is good practice, you know, it just seemed to me in this case, it just got, you know, compounded. You know, that all happens, and then he got Kratz breaking every ethical rule as a prosecutor, and today he'd have been sanctioned for it. By the way, the Supreme Court did yank his license for 4 months. That guy is creepy. Don't say that lightly. But after having read both a 98-page from the regulating committee, the Swanson, ordinance committee, as well as a Supreme Court decision, I have no idea how that man is practicing law. And I, again, don't say that lightly, but it is a problem. When you know, when we're talking about taking someone's liberty, you have got to have those ducks in a row. And if you don't have them in a row, then you have to acknowledge them. Don't cover them up. Don't, you know, just admit the mistake and go forward, because I think reasonable people will understand that. You know, I get it from both sides of the coin. I think Brendan Dassey absolutely deserves a new trial. I don't understand how it seems to me how going after the Avery case, as in Zellner. I mean, I hope I don't understand it, because if I do understand it, it means to me PR move. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. The taking someone's liberty, I will take a little bit of liberty with that comment. The person whose liberty was taken here was Teresa Halbach. And you look at the preponderance of the evidence, and I believe it shows that Stephen Avery was completely guilty in this case. When you look at evidence being planted and all of that, defense lawyers saying that the FBI results, well, I just don't trust the FBI, then you're grasping, you're throwing stuff at the wall to see if it sticks. But what I will say is that you and I have spent 2 hours now, two weeks apart, and we did some pretty gall-dang good radio, I think, analyzing a story and a case that a lot of people are looking at and are fascinated with, whether you believe he's innocent, whether you don't believe he's innocent. I don't care if 200,000 people wrote to Obama, or 500,000 people wrote to Donnie Wahlberg and said, go on, Nancy Grayson, fix this. It's the big story here, and the big story has to be looked at completely. And, ma'am, you did a wonderful job with it, as usual, and we will agree to disagree on some points, but I will say that for those of you that are listening out there, Blank and I are available for private radio shows anytime you'll... No, I'm kidding. And I do want to say that thank you. You've covered everything from stem to stern, and I will give you the last minute.
Thank you, Dan. Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so thrilled that you, you know, there's never a time where you aren't so versed in a subject that you make me think and you make me work harder, and I so value that. And I think this was a really important issue, and I'm pleased to talk about it. We may get a third out of it. I don't know, you know, what our timing is going to look like, but I'm proud of the fact that this is analysis. This is what happened. This is what should happen. It shouldn't be at face value. Don't let people cram stuff down your throat. Don't let them, you know, tell you what your opinion is.
That's right.
Stand for what you believe in and choose your advocacy. You brought up the fact that, you know, the person who lost their liberty lost her life. And no matter how you slice this thing, it was brutal. And that girl did not deserve anything that she got. And that definitely is not highlighted in anything. And that shouldn't be because the evidence can't tell you that story. Because as you pointed out in the beginning, it rarely does. But what, as reasonable people, can we glean from that? That a girl is, you know, burned every part of her body to sharps, you know, and her, you know, things from her purse, her phone goes off, he's calling her on Star 67. What is the totality of that evidence to a reasonable person? It's guilt. So even if this was planned or that happened, those are things that people should talk about and think about. But at the end of the day, you're entirely right. This woman was brutally murdered in, you know, a shithole of a place to die. Yes, anyway.
Absolutely. Listen, thank you. It's always a pleasure, and we'll sit back and watch this for a bit, and I think we'll probably be doing another show about it sometime soon.
You got it. Thank you so much, Dana. Be well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
That's Christina Stoy, and that's Making a Murderer. Think about it as you may, but look at the big picture, is that the young girl lost her life, and that's hardly looked at in this documentary. It's all about corruption, police, planting evidence, and this poor guy who's in jail and he shouldn't be. Well, I'm going to go straight for it. He's exactly where he needs to be, and the evidence showed it. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio and Access Channel 7.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.